Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia and Focus newsletter. 1 year ago, in the first days of January, Kazakhstan experienced the worst violence in the country's history. Peaceful protests that were increasingly calling for changes in the government had spread across the country in just 48 hours, but then violence broke out, and by the time order was restored, at least 238 people had been killed. The year since has seen many changes in Kazakhstan, but at the same time, many of the demands people were calling for in the first days of the protests have not been addressed. So what's different about Kazakhstan 1 year after what is referred to by some as Bloody January? To discuss all this, I am joined by William Courtney, former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan and currently an adjunct senior fellow at the Washington-based RAND Corporation, Vyacheslav Abramov, founder of the Vlast.kz news outlet in Kazakhstan, Aygerim Tolkhanova, freelance journalist from Kazakhstan and co-host of EurasiaNet's Eurasia Chat podcast, who is currently based in Prague. Thank you all for joining me. And before looking back at what's changed over the course of the year, I want to start with what's happening in Kazakhstan now, as the one-year anniversary of the tragedy is marked. Slava, you're in Almaty. What's the mood there?
You know, Bruce, it's tough to explain in like one, two sentences, because it's like it's very different from what we had last year, of course, but it's also very different if you will look to like different groups of people. It's a lot of people who are trying to forget what happened last January, and they're trying to somehow, you know, forget about trauma, somehow to forget about some actions, you know, that we saw last year, not only from the government, but also from some people, you know, in the country and outside the country. We also can see a lot of people who already, you know, already not remember anything about these January events, unfortunately for me, you know, because I do believe that as a society, we did not make two very important, you know, steps to heal from this trauma, you know. We didn't have independent investigation. We didn't have, you know, we didn't receive all answers, etc. I'm sure we will discuss it. But because of that, for part of the society, and I am part of this group, you know, it's a very sad days. And it's a lot of triggers that we see right now in Almaty, you know, like same weather, same colors, you know, and a lot of fireworks because it was a new year, you know, and you hear these fireworks, you know, and you immediately remember what happened here a year ago. So it's very different, and it's very, you know, complicated to just try to explain what's going on right now here.
Okay, thank you for explaining that. It was just, I thought it was important to kind of set the mood here about what's going on. You know, and before I go back again, I want to keep with some current events, because yesterday, the Kazakhstan's prosecutor general, Barik Asilov, gave one of the most full accounts, and this is a very relative way of putting it, but one of the most full accounts to date about what exactly happened last year. And I'll start with Aygerim. I'm sure you saw some of the news too. Did we learn anything new from the prosecutor general's comments yesterday to parliament about who was responsible, what the course of events were?
So I will not be original if I say we didn't hear anything new from what prosecutor general said yesterday. There was a statement that we can consider somehow that former chief of National Security Committee Karim Masimov can be considered as a main organizer. But still, because we as society and as public have not been shown any evidence or any clue as to what was really happening during these days, I'm sure a lot of people are skeptical about this. And I know that some part of society in Kazakhstan do believe what authorities say, that it was somehow an attempted coup. Some part of society thinks that, like, blames everything on, let's call them marginalized youth that came to Almaty. And another part of society is just confused, and I'm also part of this society because all these days, the last couple of days, I also felt very heavy on my chest and in my heart because it's a very tragic kind of memory. And we still, unfortunately, didn't even start healing from this traumatic event, and authorities are not really helping to open some of the wounds to process this. And I think, we're still a long way to go to understand what has happened and how we as society in Kazakhstan can process this and can reflect and redefine the future.
Okay, great. Thank you. Ambassador Courtney, how would you assess the way the Kazakh authorities have doled out information about this and their narrative about the course of events? There's times where, frankly, I'm baffled. They've stuck with this element of there being a foreign influence there, possibly foreign terrorists, but at the same time, they've kind of moved over without calling it an attempted coup to showing there were figures in the government that were involved in this. I mean, what's your assessment of the way the Kazakh government has handled the information war about what happened last year?
Bruce, thank you. The perception in the West is that Kazakhstan's authorities are still struggling. While they have not provided much information that really is credible, there are a number of areas where the government is struggling to make some progress, but in most areas, it's not doing that. So just from a Western perspective, when we look at how the government is trying to increase its legitimacy, and that legitimacy, frankly, is much in question. One thing that President Tokayev has done is trying to distance Kazakhstan a bit more from Russia, and that's a positive thing for the legitimacy of the government, perceived legitimacy. Another issue is cleaning up corruption. There really hasn't been much progress there, although some with regard to reducing the influence of Nazarbayev associates. But in a number of other areas, a dishonest election for the president, that's been pretty disappointing. No independent investigation of the tragedy last January, that's disappointing. Reforms, Tokayev has talked about reforms, but no reforms really are in sight. And finally, any improvement in the living standards of ordinary people. That, so far, there's been no sign there. So from a Western perspective, there's a lot of concern that the government is still struggling more than it should be at this point.
Okay, thank you. And also thank you for opening the door to the meaty part of this show, so to speak, too. And I'll get back to you right away. The role of the Nazarbayev family, and everyone will get a chance to comment on this, but I'll start with you, Ambassador Courtney. The role of the Nazarbayev family. Now, the prosecutor general was questioned about this, whether Nazarbayev himself might be under investigation. And he said there was nothing that wasn't happening at the time. And then when they asked a question about his nephew, Samata Bish, who was the deputy head of the security committee, the National Security Committee, he said that he wasn't even sure if he was in the country, and he wasn't. He had been a witness, but he wasn't a suspect. How do you view the treatment of the Nazarbayev family, who really seemed to be the core of what started the protests last year?
So in the West, there's a perception that the Nazarbayev family stole really an enormous amount, billions and billions of dollars out of the economy. And there were reflections of this in purchases in Geneva, Switzerland, London, of extraordinarily expensive houses and apartments. So from Western perspective, I think the perception is that there's really no significant effort to find and take assets from the Nazarbayev family that have been illegally obtained. So that suggests the Nazarbayev family still and Nazarbayev himself still has a lot of influence in Kazakhstan. And, of course, a lot of other families that benefited financially from association with the Nazarbayevs, they too are quite concerned, evidently, that they could be subject to some sort of check on this. But so far, the Nazarbayev family and its friends and associates seem to have been protected. And so that's a difficult issue for the government, because corruption, fighting corruption, is often one of the greatest sources of legitimacy in former Soviet states when it takes place. And of course, often it does not take place.
Okay, thank you. And Slava, I'm going to ask you now too. What about, you know, the role of Nazarbayev? At the end of last year, the parliament actually discussed the law on the first president. And it looked like they were kind of moving toward canceling the immunity that he's guaranteed. Well, what are people in Kazakhstan, how do they view the Nazarbayev family at the moment, that they seem to be untouchable for some reason?
You know, Bruce, it's two important points that I need to say before I will answer your question. First, he will still have immunity according to constitution and according to the law on the president of Kazakhstan, not law on the first president, because it was a special law, you know, designed especially for Nazarbayev and his family. But we still have a, you know, legislation on the rule of president or on the institute of presidency. And according to this law, not only current president, but also all ex-presidents, they have immunity. So Nazarbayev himself will have an immunity. His family will lose something, but we don't know yet what exactly they will lose, you know, because it's a lot of loops in legislation. It's a lot of, you know, unanswered questions. So it was the first point. And the second one, we, after a year, after January, you know, and because of previous 30 years, we don't have an independent sociological institutions or something, you know, that we can trust fully, that we can say, okay, this, you know, this poll was taken in Kazakhstan and we can fully trust this poll. You know, we understand that this is what people think, say, etc. Because of that, because we don't have, we have few institutions who are trying to provide some polls and data, you know, but I didn't ever see, you know, last year anything related to your question, any independent polls, you know, like white, organized throughout Kazakhstan, where people answered this question: do Nazarbayev need to be, you know, need to have immunity or not? What is the, you know, legacy of Nazarbayev or something like that? I can tell only based on, you know, my conversations with people or conversations of our journalists to the people, you know, around the country, because we travel a lot. And the general, you know, the general perception of Nazarbayev changed not last year, not last January, but few years ago, you know, and it's very, very negative at the moment around the country in a very different groups of population, you know, not only inside, like, you know, like ordinary people or poor people or youth people from the city centers, you know, who are traditionally very opposed to the government, but, you know, through elites, through business people, they all are extremely negative toward not only Nazarbayev, but also his family and his legacy, you know, because the strongman lost the momentum when he needed to leave his office. It was very obvious. It was very clear. And because of that, we got what we got last year. You know, he concentrated power. He concentrated money. His family owned the country, you know, for years. And because of that, we had a bloody January last year, because people were not able to see this anymore, you know. And because of that, you know, because we saw some actions, you know, against the family. But I totally agree with Ambassador Courtney. Nazarbayev himself and his relatives, his close circle, they still have a lot of power. But because we saw some actions against the family last year, I know that people quite happy with, you know, some actions against Nazarbayev himself and his relatives. But if we will, you know, go to the streets and ask people, do Tokayev and his administration, you know, or next government of Kazakhstan need to do more, need to investigate Nazarbayev and his relatives, need to, you know, return assets that they very different ways, you know, took from the country or inside the country? Of course, the answer will be yes, because people are demanding, you know, this family be investigated and being stripped from the power.
Great, thank you. And also thanks for making the distinction between the law on the president and his immunity and the law on the first president, and the fact that you could still cancel that and strip the family anyway of the immunity it enjoys under that. And Aygurim, I'm going to ask you the same question. You were just in Kazakhstan. You're speaking with people in Kazakhstan all the time. What's their attitude toward the process against the Nazarbayevs? Are people angry that they haven't gone further than they've gone, or are they satisfied that at least there seems to be some small level of accounting being demanded from Nazarbayev and his cronies?
I had quite a short trip back home to Almaty, but the people I've talked to were not mainly political activists or some people who are keeping up to date with politics, just regular people, some friends, relatives. And it seems like the majority of them kind of just want to forget what happened in January. And it's kind of standard apolitical attitude again, even though in January we have seen this peak of what this apolitical attitude can lead to as a society. I think that most of the people just go with the flow. They think that they cannot decide much in the politics, because as we can see, Tokayev has solidified the power in the last year after January events, and we see continuous authoritarianism in Kazakhstan, and there is still a lot of restrictions on the freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, media freedom, political freedoms, and people just try to process these things silently among themselves, but the majority of them just go as nothing happened, and they continue to live as January events didn't actually happen. And, when I was in Almaty, I was actually surprised to see how quickly Almaty has been restored. All the buildings have been built, and the ones that were damaged, and it looks prettier. The only thing that we have not touched yet is are those buildings in administration in the Republic Square. And I think that people just want to live their lives and again not be involved in politics. And returning to your question about Nazarbayev, I think some people are still not loyal, but they still think that Nazarbayev has done a lot of positive things in Kazakhstan, especially in the early years of independence. But they also think that in the last couple of years, when he should have left, he didn't. And that's why we are now witnessing all these problems that have been accumulating for decades. They're being exposed in various areas, whether it's economy of the country, politics, or society even, and all these different levels of injustice, inequality, lack of proper education in some parts, or a lack of even language issues. All these things that have been kind of shut down, where people were not allowed to talk publicly about it. Now people start to discuss this publicly. And I think some of the people that I know, they just starting to question what is the direction that Kazakhstan is going to. Why, for example, Tokayev is meeting with Putin while also not approving the invasion of Ukraine. Why do we have even Russian-speaking schools? Some people say that. I was surprised to hear from some people, because they studied in Russian schools, they speak Russian, they write in Russian, but they also question these kind of things that are related to the current invasion of Ukraine. So there are a lot of processes going on at the same time in society, and yeah, it's just the beginning, and as Vyacheslav rightly mentioned, it didn't start just last year. It started a few years ago, and the peak was when Nazarbayev resigned in 2019, and when people had hope that something will change, but we're still hoping that something will change, let's say.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to get into that in the second half of the show, so thank you. It was a good place to leave off. But we are at the halfway point in our discussion, so it is time for me to remind that this is the Medjlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Benier, host of the Medjlis Podcast and author of the weekly Central Asia and Focus newsletter. We're talking about the anniversary of the bloody January events in Kazakhstan last year. And joining me for this discussion are Vyacheslav Abramov, the founder of Vlas.kz news outlet in Kazakhstan, Aigrim Tolikhanova, freelance journalist from Kazakhstan and co-host of EurasiaNet's Eurasia Chat podcast, and William Courtney, former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan and currently adjunct senior fellow at the Washington-based RAND Corporation. And Aigrim, I'm going to come back to you right away. Tokayev said, this is new Kazakhstan. This was the whole thing. We were going to, he called for the amendments to the Constitution. We've seen a snap presidential election. This is all part of him creating what he calls new Kazakhstan. Do you see anything new about Kazakhstan?
Well, Tokayev and his administration, as well as different deputies and politicians in Kazakhstan, live in their own parallel reality. Whatever they say is not the case, what is happening in society, and is not their reality, reflection of reality. Tokayev has been saying a lot about new law on public assemblies, political reforms after Nazarbayev resigned, and then the snap presidential elections, another political reforms, and new Kazakhstan, and new Nur Otan party called Amanat. Fundamentally, there were no changes that would fundamentally change the whole structure, the political structure, or improve the lives of the people. Yes, there are some positive things, such as appointment of new young people, like the one that the Ministry of Ecology has been recently appointed, a young woman who has her PhD in from Japanese university and worked in UN sector. And this is a positive change, but it's just a drop in the ocean, and I'm not sure how big of a difference it will make in this whole ocean of, let's say, turbulence and problems that Kazakhstan is facing, not just internally, but also geopolitically, externally, let's say. I personally, as a citizen of Kazakhstan, I would want some bolder actions from the government, some more clarity, because there is a lot of ambiguity. It's not clear. Yeah, we all say about this multivectoral policy, that we're friends with everyone, but you can't be friends with everyone all the time if some of the fundamental values are not respected. And when you say that you respect these values, but you also become friends with someone who doesn't respect these values, to me, it's kind of a signal that it's insincere. And of course, I understand it's all the game to keep yourself safe all the time in Kazakhstan, squeezed between Russia and China. But I think it's getting to a point when people want some clarity, some direction, and some understanding of what this administration is doing and what it wants to do, and not just saying that this is a reality that is already here, but what is actually it's leading to, which reality it's leading to country. So, yeah, that's my point.
Okay, great. Thank you. And we're going to move over to foreign policy in just a second. But before we do, Slava, I'm going to give you one chance to comment on what you see that's new about new Kazakhstan. And then you're free to talk about foreign policy after that, too. But domestically, what's new about new Kazakhstan? Anything?
I can give you a very short answer. No, nothing new in the new Kazakhstan, you know, because you cannot have a new country built by old people from who, you know, who have been in power for so long. You know, they all all the people who are right now, you know, this in this, you know, program on transformation of the country, according to Tokayev, they all were involved in all previous, you know, not only reforms and changes in the countries, in the country, but also in the repressions, you know, against civil society and journalists and activists. They were involved in many, many actions, you know, that they need to, first of all, you know, be investigated for. And then if court will clear their path, will be able to do something good for the country. Because what they did in previous 30 years was obviously not very good for the country. So I don't see a lot of, you know, positive changes. I see some, of course, because we see that, you know, not only Tokayev himself, but people around him, they're trying to, you know, pretend and have this image of people who are reforming the country. But unfortunately, in reality, it's not a lot of changes. And in some fields, in some areas, it's no changes at all. Or we have even worse situation than we had before.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Courtney, let's get to you. You know, because I want to talk a little bit about the foreign policy changes in Kazakhstan. Now, some of these have clearly been forced on Kazakhstan because of the situation of Russia's war in Ukraine. It caused Kazakhstan and a lot of countries to reevaluate their relationship with Russia and kind of redirect a lot of their foreign policy. You know, admittedly, Tokayev, this should be his forte. He's got the foreign affairs background to do this kind of stuff. Has he successfully guided Kazakhstan through very turbulent waters, so to speak, the immediate foreign policy concerns for Kazakhstan?
Bruce, President Tokayev has, in fact, made some important progress. You'll recall that in the January events, he invited in Russian or CIS troops to help stabilize the situation. You know, of course, that was unpopular in Kazakhstan, and so Tokayev has since then been trying to pull back, if you will, saying explicitly that Ukraine did not support the war in, Kazakhstan did not support the war in Ukraine. Kazakhstan would not recognize Donetsk or Luhansk People's Republics, not supporting Russia in some of the UN activities, UN resolutions. So that's been a helpful step by Kazakhstan to enhance some of the integrity of its multi-vector foreign policy. But multi-vector foreign policy has never been equal vectors in all directions. Of course, Russia, China are much more important than the Western vector, for example. So I think there's some possibility for further progress. Now, one thing that should be important for Kazakhstan, as we've seen in the Ukraine war, the Ukrainians, with a lot of NATO training over the last decade, have learned how to fight in more decentralized and more agile ways. With a number of Russian hardliners, if you will, making ominous threats toward Kazakhstan, it might be helpful for some of our NATO allies to work more closely with Kazakhstan to help train its troops to fight more effectively. This doesn't have to be a high-profile activity. It wasn't in training the Ukrainian troops. But it will be important for Kazakhstan now to think about ways to enhance deterrence against any potential Russian aggression. Now, a Russian loss in Ukraine is probably one of the most helpful things for Kazakhstan to reduce threats against it. But still, at the same time, it's probably useful for Kazakhstanis to think about how to train their troops to fight more effectively in the event that Russia does try to seize some of the oblasts, the northern oblasts or other oblasts in Kazakhstan. So I think there's an opportunity here for Kazakhstan's foreign policy to strengthen the Western vector here if the Western countries are willing to cooperate with Kazakhstan in helping enhance its military capability.
Great, thank you. And this is a good point, kind of segue back a little bit into domestic politics. Slava, can you tell me how much does Tokayev's handling of the situation, the relationship with Russia, I mean, And Ambassador Courtney mentioned that there have been Russian officials who have made specific threats against Kazakh territory. Is Tokayev benefiting from this to some extent? Is it buying him some extra time, or extra patience from the people because they think he's handling the situation with Russia adequately?
You know, it's hard to say what is the perception of the population in general, but, you know, I've talked with a lot of people, and it's kind of my own opinion that it's not the, you know, bad moment for us to have the guy who is a diplomat as a leader of the country, to be honest, you know, in this situation, because it's very, very clear that he's trying to balance between very, very powerful players and between being inside very, very difficult situation. Because we see and we understand that Russia is trying to pressure Kazakhstan all the time in very different ways, you know. And I believe it's an explanation of why Tokayev and Putin meet each other and talk to each other so many times. Last year, they did it more than 20 times, you know. They met in very different places, you know, around post-Soviet countries, of course, because Mr. Putin is not welcomed anywhere in the world else. But, you know, they met one-on-one many times. They talked by phone many, many times. And I believe it was a lot of attempts, you know, not only from Putin himself, but from Russian officials in a different ways, you know, including some public threats and some public posts and comments that they are making to, you know, to force Kazakhstan to recognize these two quasi-states, you know, that Russia control in Ukraine, or, you know, to support the war in general. And the fact that Tokayev didn't do that is a good news for us here, you know, because I do believe that in general Kazakh society will never forgive to anyone, including Tokayev, if it will be a full support of the war or something like that. But at the same time, Kazakh society understand that it's not an easy way, you know, to handle this situation. And it's some strange steps, you know, including, you know, some votes in UN, as an example, you know, when Kazakhstan did not support the resolution asking Russia to leave Ukrainian territory. And at the same time, it's some statements by Tokayev, including statements in the same room with Putin, when Tokayev denied to recognize these republics, you know. It's a mix feelings here about what's going on with our relations with Russia. And at the same time, you know, it's very, very clear for the society here. And I really hope, and I'm saying it, you know, all the time since the end of February last year, I really hope that Kazakh government understand that we need to find the solutions to not being so dependent on Russia on every level, including economy. And because government is trying to find some solutions, and it's clear, we see it. I believe people in the government, including, you know, the highest level officials, they all understand that, and they are working on that. Because no matter how fast Ukraine will win, you know, our dependency on Russia in military, in economy, in trade, even in the corridors for our oil and gas, it makes no sense. We need to work on that, and we need to find a way to be less dependent on this neighbor. Of course, we will forever be neighbors, you know, but we can be much more independent, and the last year showed it. And I really hope that it will be one of the results for Kazakhstan of this war, of this situation in general.
Okay, thank you. Igorim, you know, with any candidate, with any leader, there's some things you like about him and some things you don't like about him. You know, you've already said that his domestic reforms so far haven't gone anywhere. But the people you talk to, or you yourself, you know, his foreign policy, how is that rating in Kazakhstan? I mean, do people that you know appreciate the fact that the stance that he's taken on Russia, are they satisfied with that?
I agree with previous speakers that, of course, everyone, it's clear, not just inside the country, but outside, that it's a very difficult and unpredictable situation Kazakhstan is in. And it is obvious that Tokayev, as a top diplomat, is in his, let's say, best shape to navigate this very difficult reality. But also, I came to some conclusion, it's just my own personal observation, that in terms of foreign policy and connection to domestic situation, I have talked to some people who are also openly pro-Russian, and they watch Russian TV, and they, like in Kazakhstan, there are a lot of people who were fleeing mobilization from like Russian people, right? And in Europe, for example, it's vice versa. There are a lot of Ukrainians. And in Kazakhstan, one person even said, we have refugees from Russia, not from Ukraine. And I just noticed this kind of, I don't know if it's a trend or tendency, but a lot of people are, from the ones that I've talked to, they may not publicly say that they support war, but they support, for example, Putin, and they do believe that Ukraine is a Nazist country or something like that. And I know from some circle of some of my acquaintances that their parents, for example, even after the invasion, they decided to move to Russia. And there is this kind of awkward situation in which this person has their parents in a different country, but this person identifies themselves as a Kazakhstani and has Kazakhstani identity, but their parents have kind of different identity. So this is another process that is going on currently in Kazakhstan in terms of de-Sovietization, decolonization, let's call it, where people are trying to understand who are they as a person, as a, I don't know, belonging to a certain state, to a certain culture. And yeah, and there are also changes culturally and the attitude towards Russia and what it brought as a Soviet legacy. So yeah, a lot of processes going on, and I think each person in their head also kind of trying to make sense of what is there for them. And I think that's why maybe there is a lot of confusion everywhere and a lot of ambiguity and not so clear what is the exact direction in terms of where authorities are going, in terms of what society is as a one, because there are different parts of society that have different opinions on different fundamental things. And yeah, it's a very complicated country, let's say.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, we're getting close to the end of the program, and I'm going to give you all a chance to say anything that you thought we didn't cover that you wanted to comment on. But also with a mention that after last year's events finally settled down, there were several people who had said they thought that that was only the first time that was going to happen, that if things didn't change, the same things that happened last January would happen in Kazakhstan again. And possibly actually overthrow the government the next time around. So with that in mind, you know, where do you think, where should Kazakhstan be going, but where is the process, the progress or lack of progress? How long can that situation keep going before we end up back where we were in January? And I'll start with Slava.
It's a very tough question, Bruce. To be honest, I have no answer. I have no idea how long it can take for some people in around the current president to understand that, because it's clear for you, it's clear for me, it's clear for our friends who are right now here, and I'm pretty sure it's clear for many, many other people. But unfortunately, I have a feeling that it's not fully clear for some people in the government, you know, because we saw it during last years of Nazarbayev. He was not really in contact with reality. You know, he made some strange statements. He made some really strange, you know, comments about economy, about, poor people, about different things. And unfortunately, you know, what we see in Kazakhstan right now, yes, people in power are smarter, and their statements maybe not that stupid, but they're trying to, you know, run away from reality. They're trying to run away from real reforms and real changes that Kazakhstan definitely needs to have, you know, to improve the situation in many, many areas, including not only like politics, but also economy and, you know, social situation and social justice and many, many other things, you know. So I really hope that, because unfortunately, you know, we are still an autocratic country, and we still cannot expect that, you know, we can have a people's movement or grassroots movement, you know, that will just make a great statement, or, you know, just say that the society have this wish and then government will do some steps. Unfortunately, we cannot expect something like that, you know, because we still have very, very repressive legislation. We still have, we saw a lot of actions against civil society and activists last year since January events, since Bloody January. So we cannot expect, you know, these, you know, formation or changes of the country from the grassroots, from the people. You know, we unfortunately still can have it only from the top, from the government. So my understanding, you know, we need to talk more about that. We need to, you know, say out loud that this country is demanding changes, demanding reforms. And it was a lot of hopes on Tokayev after Nazarbayev resignation. And it was very clear that people are expecting some positive changes from the new president, from his administration. I think that he is losing this time. I think that the part of the society have a lot of questions toward his actions, not only during January last year, but also before and after that. And it will be more and more questions. It will be more and more unanswered questions. And I really hope that really soon people in the government will understand that they need to address these questions. They need to change their attitude. They need to work with civil society. They need to not play games, you know, that they're reformists, you know, that they're doing reforms, but they need to do a real job. And I still have a lot of hopes, and I am optimist, and I am talking to you from Almaty. It means that I believe in my country, and I believe in the future of my country. Unfortunately, in the last year, I didn't see a lot of understanding of these things from the government, and I hope it will change pretty soon.
Okay, thank you. Igorim, last comment from you. And also, do you think the Kazakh government has learned any lessons from what happened last year?
I don't know. I don't think they learned some big lessons from what happened in January last year. I think that as Tokayev has cemented his power this year, he's now trying to navigate it and trying to keep it under control. But there should be also an understanding that society has changed, if not dramatically, but it did change after January events, and it is traumatized, and it is still recovering, and it will demand some answers and actions from the government. I think everything that Vyacheslav said, I agree with. But I also wanted to note about the people themselves. Those from civil society, they're already doing their best. They work with their big hearts, trying to improve things in Kazakhstan. But I also want to notice the people that are working now in the government, this young pool of people that are educated with Bolashak or other scholarship programs. I know some of them, And there is some understanding on their side that they need to work harder and to improve the situation because there are so many problems. But unfortunately, some of them, they're also trying to imitate what the older generation is doing, trying to ignore the problems or say that, oh, these people, they just complain all the time and they don't offer any solutions and they don't see all these barriers to which they cannot politically participate in making decisions. So I hope that this younger generation of those who are involved in politics in Kazakhstan, they will also be more compassionate to their own people and that they will try to really get into the point of what people are shouting about, even though they can shout about something like give us the money. But what is the very root of the problem? It's not that they just want money. It's that the social policy is not working properly. It's that the different other policies are not working in Kazakhstan. So I really hope that they will think through these policies and they will make some fundamental changes that are in their hands that they can do within this current very restricted authoritarian political system.
Okay, thank you. And Ambassador Courtney, you were the U.S. ambassador in Kazakhstan in the early 1990s, which could best be described as a chaotic time for Kazakhstan, and yet they managed to salvage themselves and pull themselves out of it. You know, last year, another chaotic time at the start of the year. What do you think is important for Kazakhstan moving forward?
So in the early 1990s, actually, it wasn't quite so chaotic. It was just beginning de novo, if you will. And as was mentioned earlier, you know, President Nazarbayev actually did accomplish a lot in the early 1990s. But of course, as we all know, he stayed on too long. For the current government, the promise of reform appears not to be credible. So as we see in so many other countries, real reforms only come from bottom-up political pressure. They don't come from top-down decisions by elites to basically reduce their power and share power with others. What we saw last January was protests which started in one area spread quickly to the rest of the country. It's quite possible, maybe even likely, that this is going to happen again because ordinary people don't see their lives getting better. They see the government just as repressive as before. And when it happens again, hopefully it won't be co-opted by security forces and others who turn to violence. But the spread of, if you will, a color revolution of the kind that you know we've seen in both Ukraine and Georgia. In both cases, color revolutions led to more open societies with significant democratic gains, fighting of corruption in Georgia after the Rose Revolution. Central Asia is not Ukraine or Georgia, but the Kazakhstanis have higher expectations now. They're well-educated. As Aguirre pointed out, there are a lot of Bolshoi graduates back in Kazakhstan who have expectations that really are not being fulfilled in the kind of repressive situation now. So unless the Tokayev government makes some genuine reforms, I think the situation is going to be vulnerable to another political or social uprising at some point. So I believe Kazakhstan's Western friends are very much encouraging reforms because they think that would be a way to help improve conditions and reduce the risk of protests that could turn violent.
And that's a good way to end the program, too. And I'm sorry, we do have to end the show, but this topic is so big, we could go on about this for days, actually, to try to try to recount everything that's been going on and where it's headed. But I want to give a thank you to Aigarim and to Ambassador Courtney and to Vyacheslav for being on the program with me. And a big thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week.